Hi, and welcome to The Correspondent, a podcast from the Foreign Correspondents Club of Hong Kong. My name is Zella Chin. I'm a journalist governor of the board of the FCC, talking to you downstairs in Burt's, a bar, bistro, and jazz club in the FCC building here in Hong Kong. So don't be surprised if you hear some glasses clinking or people talking in the background. And sitting with me here is Jared Watt, fellow member of the FCC and also producer of the podcast. Hey, Jared.
Hey Zella, great to be here. And I think someone's just started playing a game of pool behind us. So you probably hear a few balls being knocked around on the velvet there.
So Jared, I can't help but notice it's been some time since our last episode of The Correspondent. What's been happening?
What can I say, Zella? But it's been a very busy 6 months since we last recorded or published anything for the FCC, but I'm here to say we are back in the swing for the Year of the Dragon. But I'm very excited about who we've managed to get on the mic for this upcoming episode. You're going to hear our colleague Christina Panton present a special audio adaptation of the cover story in the latest print edition of The Correspondent magazine, tracing the history of the Foreign Correspondents Club back to its beginnings when about a dozen foreign journalists left Shanghai in 1949 to move here to Hong Kong. And there's been some fascinating stories of different incarnations of the FCC around Hong Kong. One of them featured in a Hollywood movie. Some of the characters of the FCC featured in one very famous spy novel by John le Carré. And we're also going to hear a special interview about the living heritage of the room we're sitting in right now. I'm talking about a man whose voice is immediately recognizable for anyone who's visited Burt's Bar.
I probably die on stage with them. The serious chord fall off. Check this out. Bye.
That could only be one man.
That's right. That is the voice of Alan Youngblood, the composer, pianist, and bandleader who played the opening night of this room back in 1997 and has continued to play here, as well as book the other musicians and bands who've played here ever since.
First, we're going to talk with some people who are very near and dear to my heart. We're going to have a chat with two people who represent the new generations of journalists who are members here at the FCC. They're the recipients of this year's Claire Hollingworth Fellowship.
Now, Zella, you should probably let people know a little bit more about Claire Hollingworth, why her name carries so much gravitas in this building. But in the meantime, I'm going to go to the bar. What are you having?
Well, normally I take a champagne, but since I'm on the mic, just some water, please. So before I introduce you to our Claire Hollingworth fellows, let me give you a brief outline of who Claire Hollingworth was and why we have honored her memory with a fellowship ever since her death in 2017. Claire Hollingworth famously broke the biggest story of the last century, the outbreak of World War II. She filed the first story reporting the buildup of German tanks on the Polish border. And famously, a day later, she rang the British embassy from her location in Poland and held the phone out of the window to convince them that, yes, this was the sound of German troops and tanks invading. But she didn't stop there. For 5 decades, she reported war and conflict from all over the globe. She flew planes, parachuted out of them, was the first female defense correspondent for The Guardian, met the last Shah of Iran, Zhou Enlai, and Jiang Qing, and reported on the Cultural Revolution. And for more than 30 years, Claire made Hong Kong her home. She was a near-daily visitor to the FCC until her death at age 105. To honor the legacy of Claire Hollingworth as one of the greatest correspondents in history, the Claire Hollingworth Fellowship is given to early career journalists and journalism school students in Hong Kong to nurture a new generation of journalists. We've named 3 fellows for this year, and we've managed to get 2 of them here for a chat. Mitho Agarwal and Arujan Zanula are with me, while the 3rd fellow, Eudora Wong, is of course off somewhere on assignment. Mitho, Arujan, hello, welcome.
Hi, Zella.
Hi, Zella.
So what brings you to the FCC? Can you tell us a bit about what brought you to journalism and Hong Kong?
Well, so it's been about almost 5 years. I came here as a student. I was an engineering student because that's what you do when you're brown.
Where did you come from?
From India. So I was born and raised in New Delhi, and I was always a computer science guy. So I thought I would be the same guy in uni, and I thought I would, and I came and I enrolled in HKU. Then COVID hit, and I was frankly bored. So I was like, okay, I need to do something else that is going to be not just computer science because it's frankly boring. So after first year, I kind of dropped the whole thing. I was like, okay, let's see something else. So I started doing politics. And then politics was fun in the sense of understanding how the world works, yada, yada, yada. But I hated doing the academic writing of it. It was really painful. And so at the same time, I was listening to a lot of podcasts. They were really like taking up. And so I started making my own. And then I thought, well, you know, it's kind of journalistic in a way. But I hated the connotation of news and media. Just because of the fact that how we have grown up watching news in India, it's very sensational, almost like Bollywood. So, but then after some point, I was like, okay, well, let's try an internship. And then I interned at NBC 2 years ago. And then since then, I just stuck with it. So here I am.
Aru, what about you? So I moved to Hong Kong around 3 years ago for my studies at the university. And I'm now a final year student studying journalism at HKBU. So what brings me to journalism is during my high school, we had a school newspaper. And at first, I started with that. I was just writing some articles that I don't even want to read now. And then I decided to apply for journalism school. I got admitted and moved to Hong Kong. After my third year, I did an internship with CNN. And after that, I realized that this is what I'm going to do in the future.
So we've been through some tough times in the journalism industry, but looking at the headlines over the past few months, it's particularly bad news, both in terms of job losses as well as technology like ChatGPT threatening the future of our jobs. So how are you feeling about the future of journalism?
I want to feel hopeful about the future of journalism. Well, ChatGPT threatening the future of our jobs, I don't really think that it will be threatening our jobs that much. But we as journalists can incorporate usage of ChatGPT in our work for researches or, let's say, to brainstorm on the ideas for your stories. Michael, what do you think?
I don't know. I think when people thought about newspapers taking dying and broadcast taking jobs, that happened. But everybody just let the whole industry die. No, I think tools come and go and technology is something that will happen regardless if you like it or not. And the problem with that industry, I think, is just that we are too stuck up on old methods. And those who will adapt will be fine, and those who don't will just fade into oblivion. And so I think that just applies to this as well. It's not just about journalism, it's just any industry, any job in general, I think.
So you're both early in your careers, but you have some significant experiences in journalism already. Can you tell us some of the stories you're most proud of working on over the past couple of years?
I'll go. This is the only story that I talk about, honestly, these days. But it's just one story I did about half a year ago, and it was a very grim story in the beginning, and still is. And the more I dug into it, it became just worse. There's a tendency from Northern Africa for people to go on boats and migrate to Europe for better conditions. You know, they face war, they face poverty and everything back where they come from. And so the idea is always, if you think about it intuitively, is that someone's on a boat and they're crying for help. What do? You go out and rescue them, right? But in this case, that doesn't happen. These boats would take off from, say, Libya or Tunisia, and they would like end up in the Mediterranean Sea. And they would always call for help because that sea is horrible and the conditions there and the waves can be very, very high and the boats are dingy and they are like overloaded with hundreds of migrants. So obviously what's going to happen is that these boats get damaged in the storm and get toppled or engine loss, whatever. Governments in the region get to know about these boats because they will cry for help. They cry Mayday on radio frequencies. And Malta is one of those places which falls right in the middle of this, of the journey they're trying to make from, let's say, Libya to, say, Sicily. And in the convention of sea, there's a thing where if you are in certain territorial waters, that the country that is responsible for those waters is also responsible for rescuing you and providing help. And what we found out in our story was that Malta was actively trying not to help boats. And we found documents where they were explicitly telling boats and the nearby other ships that were fine, like merchant ships and like shipping vessels, to not go and rescue them. Because the moment they would go and take some migrants on board, the responsibility is obviously to bring them back on shore to Malta. And then Malta has to take care of them as refugees. And credit to Malta, however, is that since it's so small and so tiny, the number of migrants it has taken per capita is already so high. And people in Northern Europe just love to parade Malta and other countries in the south for not doing enough, while they are the ones taking pretty much nobody. And so
So what happens to those migrants on those boats?
They die. That's it. That's the only thing that can happen. If they get rescued, then yeah, sure. Then they can go and apply as a refugee in asylum and then get the whole EU protection program. But that is only after they reach. If they don't reach, they die. That's it. But if they do reach without being helped, so they usually end up getting trafficked. And that's also quite grim. But the chances of them reaching to a port and getting trafficked are less than them actually surviving. So
it's important that you shed a light on this story.
Yeah, I mean, there's been many stories about this. EU is notoriously known for its maritime force, and there were stories in 2021 where they were paying off Libyan Coast Guard to bring these people back to Libya, even if they hadn't gone from Libya. So they were financing Libyan Coast Guard to say, go up, get these people, find them in the sea, and bring them back to Libyan shore so that they could then torture them and then put them in centers where they could not escape, and potentially try to go at sea to reach Europe again. Still happens all the time.
So Aru, what about you? What are some significant stories you've worked on?
So last summer, during my internship at CNN, I was working on the Xinjiang detention story. Xinjiang detentions of Kazakh nationals, and being a person from Kazakhstan myself, this topic was of a particular interest to me. So Xinjiang region of China is a home for over 1 million ethnic Kazakhs who were born there or who moved there during last centuries. There is also a Belt and Road Initiative between Kazakhstan and China, and Kazakh government doesn't want to speak about these problems because they are relying on China because of the economic ties. And as a result, many people whose relatives are being held in those so-called detention camps in Xinjiang region are being silenced by the Kazakh government. And while working on that project, I have reached out to many NGOs working with relatives of the Xinjiang people, and also many people whose relatives are being held there right now. So that was a very significant story to work on, but also it was very heart-touching and horrible for me as well, because many of my interviewees, they cried during our calls. Some of them had their mothers or brothers being detained, or even those who died there. And it was really heartbreaking to see, and also to see that the government is still silencing those voices. So yeah, that was one of the projects I was working on.
So Mithil, you're no stranger to podcasting yourself. Tell us a bit about the Curiously Candid podcast you produced and presented.
Yeah, so it's been like, 2 years since I've been on mic, so it's just kind of refreshing to be back. that was something, as I said earlier, I was really bored, and it was COVID, and I was like, okay, I can't really go out. And Hong Kong had some of the toughest restrictions when it came to COVID all throughout. So I started, and it was also the time where there was a lot of protests, not just in Hong Kong the year prior, but also Thailand, Belarus, and there were a couple of other countries who were seeing a lot of political turmoil, as we call it. So I decided that, you know what, it would be nice to just like talk to people there and see what they're seeing and kind of bring that to an audience that is not in those regions, and which was going to be pretty much my friends, or just people who come across this randomly on Spotify. And so that was the thing. And then I was just like, okay, you know what, I'm going to make this. I came with a very stupid name. I still think it's very stupid. Made a few episodes, and then the reason why I say we is because then I started to kind of build a team around this. I was like, okay, I can't be the only guy who's hosting it, then also booking people, then also editing the whole thing. And it's a lot of work for 10 listeners. I had a friend come on, and then I had another friend come on. So it kind of became like a three team where I would produce it, my friend would host it, and then my other friend would sort of manage like all the tech with me, and as well as like helping editing, which is great. So then we started making a kind of five-part episode series, we call this, called In the Gray Zone. And this was focused on Hong Kong because we always thought, okay, you know what, we're talking so much about the rest of the world, why don't we talk about Hong Kong in particular? So we tried to get different guests on board. One was a cop, one was Ronnie Tong, the executive counselor in Hong Kong, then there was other district councillors and journalists. And so our idea was to make more of an audio documentary than it is just a podcast. So it was very heavily edited, with so much of like post-production work, try to make it about 25 minutes and to see really that it's just, and the reason why we call it In the Gray Zone was because we wanted to talk about how it's not just black and white sometimes. It's also, there's different shades. And that was the thing. And then that kind of became my sort of segue into actual journalism from that point on, because it was everything as, you know, acting as a producer, acting as a host and sort of booking people. And that kind of really gave a solid foundation when it came to this. I never learned how to write, to be honest, as formally. But then at least like doing that and seeing like shit ton of script and being like, okay, and to edit this out and like figuring out exactly how to book people while nobody taught you was like, honestly, was pretty good. And you get to apply that in your job daily now, which is also pretty nice.
Fantastic. You'll be producing our next podcast.
No, sure.
All right, Aru, you're working at CNN while also finishing your studies here in Hong Kong, and you've been working in one of the newest concepts to news gathering. It's called OSINT, meaning open source intelligence. Can you tell us what that actually is and how that's changed journalism?
So OSINT, open source intelligence, is the usage of basically everything that we see on the web. It's the social media posts, it's the government's official announcements, it's also about the maps and satellites and basically everything that you can find on web. So journalists lately have been integrating OSINT in their reporting, and we have seen that being used a lot in the coverage of the conflicts and wars. So on my Telegram, I have thousands of notifications every day because I follow basically so many pro-Russian groups as well as Ukrainian groups as well. So basically what we do, how do we use these Telegram channels for the coverage of the Russia-Ukraine war is we find some videos that go viral there, and if they have significance, let's say if that is the footage of drone hitting somewhere, then we can geolocate that video using the satellite maps, using some other information that can be gotten from the video or from the footage. But also, it would be easier if, for example, some of the footage has Russian or Ukrainian Cyrillic text on it. So let's say if that is the street name, then it would be easier for us to find the street and the exact location on the map. But also, for example, when the Prigozhin plane crashed, there was a big news everywhere in the world. And the first thing I saw when I woke up in the morning is that the video of Prigozhin's plane being crashed has been getting viral on Telegram channels, but then it wasn't yet approved by the government, so no official information yet. So what we did is that we were looking for the location of the plane crash, and a whole team of OSINT geolocators were working on it, getting the exact place where the plane crashed.
So in a sense, you're both examples of a new generation of journalists using new technology or new platforms. So let me ask you, how does a journalist your age get their news today?
So as I said previously, I use Telegram a lot. Apart from Telegram, I have the news applications on my phone installed. And first thing in the morning, I go to the applications. And if there is something very important happening in the world, then I will get the notification on my phone. And apart from that, I use TweetDeck.
What applications are you looking at?
I have the applications of the New York Times and CNN.
Yeah, I have the Plague, and the Plague is called X, formerly known as Twitter. And every morning, I think just this instinctively happened. And I kind of hate myself for it now. But now I'm just so addicted in a way just to use that as my primary source of information. And kind of I've gotten used to following the journalists in the particular region that I want to explore, or publications themselves. But then also these, like, I think nowadays is one thing that people look at is these aggregator accounts on both on Instagram and Twitter, where just these very shitty accounts, but like they'll just copy paste all the headlines from all the publications on all regions, doesn't matter what. And there's not a bad way of looking at it if you just want to just quickly see what the headlines are. So that's one thing.
No, what are your favorite aggregators?
I don't know, honestly. It's just like, there's one account on Twitter called The Spectator Index, I think. I think that's the one. Usually late, and these are like not breaking, like you cannot trust them at all, but like it gives you a sense of like what's being talked about, I guess that works. And then now just I've started I'm really trying hard to build this habit of like actually reading websites, and by websites I mean like the, let's say the Guardian or the BBC, but like I'm really trying. I was never in the habit of doing that, and I'm still not, but I'm trying. In my Chrome, I've put in a bookmarks folder, and every time I start my work I'll click on it, and then it'll pop everything open, and I'll read one by one all of these. That's what I'm trying. But if you think how people nowadays get some news, I think nobody really believes in the value of information now. What I mean by that is information in itself is no longer the commodity. Back when you still had newspapers, that was the thing. Okay, you're getting to know through the newspapers, and that's what they were building money off. I think now it's so easy for random Instagram accounts, random people to post stuff about that is news. You don't really see that much value. So I think people now are turning towards trusted sources, and they are buying subscriptions. Like New York Times is a great example. You have other publications, independent publications coming up, which are focusing on a very niche area that people are willing to pay for because they want trusted commentary or trusted analysis on a certain topic or certain region from by certain people. And they express that loyalty in terms of subscriptions. So I think that's what's happening. If I look at what my friends, how they consume news, they all have their favorite place where they go and get news. And for me, it's just still going to be Twitter, because I need to see what's happening before it makes news so that I can make news.
So what about your friends? Would you agree with the research that Generation Z is getting their news primarily from Instagram?
Well, we can say that is true to some extent. Speaking from my friends, many of them don't read actual news, but they consume them through Instagram, being just subscribed to those news agencies they usually read. And my friends, they get news, some of them get news only through Instagram news agencies accounts.
Yeah, but apart from the agencies, they also have these emerging personalities, right, if I may call it. People who are independent journalists. Gaza is a very good example. You've had so many people come up and just post videos, and because foreign journalists can't go in, so you have Gazans posting on the internet who are local journalists themselves, gain so much popularity and following online. Just that is enough for like a lot of people to be like, okay, this is my definitive source of everything on Gaza. I do not trust anybody else. And that's also happening. Even in India, there's many, many sort of ex-legacy journalists who used to work in big broadcasters but now have been bought off by big conglomerates and don't really appeal to independence or whatever. But people who used to work there now have their own YouTube channels. But that is also a way of people getting their news. Goes back to the point of loyalty, right? So people are really trying to see who is loyal to the news, and then so they can be loyal to that person. That's the way.
All right, so let's talk about the future. What stories do you want to work on in the new year?
This is the election year. Big elections all across the globe. We're looking at a potential Trump presidency. I don't really care, to be honest. But I mean, for me personally, there's a lot of elections in Asia. Some have already happened, some are in the way, some will be happening in the upcoming months. For me also, I mean, India is obviously a big part. It's going to have massive elections in April, May. Those are going to be fun to see because in India, elections are like a spectacle. It's just like fun to watch. Democracy, not so much, but otherwise, great fun. And then you also have just generally in the region. So I think that would be the big focus this year for me, at least.
Aru, what about you? So I don't have a particular story to work on this year, but since I'm graduating soon, and I think the biggest story for me would be finding a job here in Hong Kong as an international journalist.
Aru, we definitely hope you'll find a job here in Hong Kong. Mitho, Arujan, thank you guys for stopping by. We'll no doubt see you at the events at the FCC throughout the year. Arujan, Mitho, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Della.
Thank you.
Well, I'm sitting here in Bert's, where it's very quiet on a Sunday afternoon, with Christina Panton, a correspondent who's worked across Asia with Reuters, but she's with me here to help me do something a little bit different on this podcast. Hey, Christina.
Hey, Jared.
What have you got for us?
Well, you know, the theme of this month's edition of The Correspondent is heritage. So let me give you a special audio adaptation of the cover story by Kate Whitehead, titled 80 Years of Stories. Now, Kate's story takes us back to 1949, when 11 members of the Foreign Correspondents Club in Shanghai moved to Hong Kong and opened a small club in a three-room house at 61 Coldwall Road. Now, that building's still there. You can find it just behind the residences for the University of Hong Kong, near the start of the Morning Trail. But that was only a temporary move because in 1951, the brother of the then manager of the FCC received a hot tip, and the FCC moved to a luxurious mid-level mansion at 41A Conduit Road. It was an impressive multi-story house with Italian fireplaces, an expansive lawn, and harbor views. Its luxury and reputation was only enhanced when it became the very first private residence to have an elevator installed in Hong Kong. And thus it became the venue for monthly luncheons for the various diplomatic corps, while outside portions of the lawn were rented out for companies to host their annual dinners. And of course, visiting journalists could even rent rooms in this opulent multi-story mansion. The building was subsequently demolished, sad to say, to make way for a high-rise housing apartment block in the 1970s. But you can still see what it looked like in the 1955 movie, Love is a Many Splendid Thing, starring William Holden and Jennifer Jones.
My father was Chinese. My mother was English. I think of myself as Chinese, however. I know exactly how you feel. The minute I put on a Chinese frock, I feel Chinese.
I tell you, if you have capital invested here, you can double your money in Hong Kong in 3 months.
Money. And then a new era beckoned, starting with a move in 1963 to a new home on the fourth floor of the Hilton Hotel in Central. This was when a fresh influx, a new generation if you want to say that, of correspondents coming through the FCC stores. These were arriving from the ever-escalating Vietnam War.
The dust of the overthrow still hangs over Saigon, but for the young, there is time to be young.
Every 3 months or so, these war correspondents and photojournalists would get 7 days leave in Hong Kong, and for some, it began a long-lasting relationship as members of the FCC. In fact, you can see the photo taken by one of our beloved members of the FCC hanging on the wall of the bar today. And you'll know it as soon as I describe it to you. It's of an American Huey helicopter hovering above a rooftop as people clamber aboard. That's the photo taken by Hugh Vaness. Now, Hugh was the president of the FCC from 1982 to 1983, and he also started the FCC Wall Committee, which today now organizes monthly exhibitions on the back wall of the main bar. You need to check it out if you never have. Now, back to the 1960s. There was a direct link between the amount of money spent by visiting journalists on drinks at the Hilton location and the income flowing to the FCC, allowing the FCC to save up and invest in its next location. In 1969, 2 years after the riots in Hong Kong had made worldwide news, and the year some of these journalists covered a particular battle of the Vietnam War they would call Hamburger Hill, the club moved to a new location in Sutherland House on the Central Waterfront. This particular incarnation of the FCC was spread over several floors, with casual dining on the 14th floor, formal dining on the 15th, and a work and games room on the 18th. But the building itself was also the home of a legendary bar and restaurant in the basement called the Go Down. And at the same time, it was also headquarters for the RTHK News. And thus, a new legend began to be carved, born of, guess what? Heavy drinking and high jinks. One previous article in The Correspondent on the reputation of Sutherland House mentions the womb-like design of the bar, which ensured sounds carried very clearly, and thus the salty words used by journalists critiquing each other's work were clearly overheard, and barroom brawls were constantly breaking out. Kate Whitehead's article talks about one character admitting to getting into his head that a living journalist should not have a bust on display. And thus he sent a rather large bust of Richard Hughes toppling off its plinth. Now, Richard Hughes, or Dick as he was called by friends and colleagues, was a long-term president of the FCC. And guess what? You can still see that bust on display as you walk into the foyer of the FCC today. Now, when you walk upstairs to the Chinese restaurant, you notice it's called the Hughes Room. But people around the world were introduced to both Richard Hughes and the FCC in 1977 when John le Carré wrote his novel, The Honorable Schoolboy. John le Carré passed away in 2020. So how about we use an AI to read the introduction he published for The Honorable Schoolboy?
Last, there is the great Dick Hughes, whose outward character and mannerisms I have shamelessly exaggerated for the part of Old Craw. Some people, once met, simply elbow their way into a novel and sit there till the writer finds them a place. Dick is one. I am only sorry I could not obey his urgent exhortation to libel him to the hilt. My cruelest efforts could not prevail against the affectionate nature of the original.
This is what John le Carré wrote about the character Old Craw, whom he based on Richard Hughes.
In their tireless pursuit of legends about one another, Old Craw was their ancient mariner. Craw had shaken more sand out of his shorts, they told each other, than most of them would ever walk over, and they were right. In Shanghai, where his career had started, he had been tea boy and city editor to the only English-speaking journal in the port. Since then, he'd covered the communists against Chiang Kai-shek and Chiang against the Japanese and the Americans against practically everyone. Craw gave them a sense of history in this ruthless place. His style of speech, which at typhoon times even the hardiest might pardonably find irksome, was a genuine hangover from the 30s, when Australia provided the bulk of journalists in the Orient, and the Vatican, for some reason, the jargon of their companionship. Perhaps a more realistic point of departure is a certain typhoon. Saturday, in mid-1974, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, when Hong Kong lay battened down waiting for the next onslaught. In the bar of the Foreign Correspondents Club, a score of journalists, mainly from former British colonies, Australian, Canadian, American, fooled and drank in a mood of violent idleness, a chorus without a hero. 13 floors below them, the old trams and double-deckers were caked in the mud-brown sweat of building dust and smuts from the chimney stacks in Kowloon. The tiny ponds outside the high-rise hotels prickled with slow, subversive rain. And in the men's room, which provided the club's best view of the harbour, young Luke, the Californian, was ducking his face into the hand basin, washing the blood from his mouth.
This scene and the reference before it all come together in the present day. If you have ever set foot inside the male toilets in the current building, because a photo of the 13th floor view of the harbor from the men's toilets at Sutherland hangs above the urinals. And I have to confess, I have never seen this. But also, let me tell you more about the living heritage of the current FCC building. Now, the name of the door may be Burt's, but this is the house that Alan built. Because as you walk down the stairs, there's a very good chance you'll be hearing the piano and a band playing. Or else, you'll be hearing a group of musicians that Alan has booked to play. In 1999, when Burt's opened, Alan Youngblood was the performer launching this new bar and performance space. And you know what? He's been the musical director ever since.
Now, Alan was born in the Virgin Islands, the son of a Lutheran preacher who grew up playing church gospel in the mornings and jazz at night. And for a while, he made a living as a touring jazz musician based in Seattle.
Well, in the U.S., I never played in a hotel. Jazz clubs, performances, artists in residencies, and stuff like that. State artists in residency for North Carolina for 3 years, 1 year in Virginia. I had enough, no offense, but I had enough of the South. Need to go back. And I had a friend, John Belmont, who's an agent, but he books Asia, you know, Tokyo, South Korea, on and on and on. He's always calling me up, Alan, I really need a band to go to Hong Kong. I said, Hong Kong, okay. How long? 3 months, 3 month option. Because all I had to do is make it back to Washington State and getting ready for the jazz festivals in Canada and the Pacific Northwest. And, you know, just needed a change of scenery. You know, so it ended up being at the Grand Hyatt at JJ's, 1992. I've been here since 1992. I can't believe it. And then it turns out that this was like one of the top venues. You're living at the Grand Hyatt. Six-piece band. It was very funny. And that led to, because a lot of entertainment industry people would come up there, and a few of us stayed here because you got other jobs. And then the other ones, a lot of them went into the cantopop field, which made good money. And I'm sure they didn't want to go back to South Carolina. I wouldn't. And then when they had SARS here, a number of those guys moved to Shanghai. They're still there. They ended up marrying Shanghainese women and got kids. They like I live here, they live there. And then there's an influx of particularly Australian musicians, and they're all very good. So it keeps evolving.
On the walls of Burt's, you can see framed posters of the giants of blues and jazz, along with autographed photos from the likes of the Beach Boys, Blondie, Jimmy Buffett, and many more. You've heard the saying, if these walls could talk, Alan can talk to you about the walls.
I don't know if he had been in this area before. It was like, you know, ugly. And all of a sudden it's this. It looks like a nightclub, basically. A lot of these posters on the wall were donated by PJ O'Rourke. And the other ones were taken by Hugh Van Ness, so you can't go wrong there. And those ones over there, you know, I'm sitting here at the piano and behind me is a table. And there's this guy and this guy's just sketching it in pencil. So it's pretty good. Boy, you ain't seen nothing yet. And then it ends up being like that. Ken McDonald, famous illustrator from New York, Hugh Van Ness's friend. So, but look at this place. You're sitting here, the people in the audience. This looks like a nightclub that serves good food.
And he can talk to you at length about the great musicians who have come downstairs to play.
Eugene Powell, guitar. Ted Lowe, keyboards. Blaine Whitaker from Sydney, alto sax and flute. If you can get a man play the flute, you know. Scott Dodd. You got Anthony Fernandez, drums. He's from Goa, India. Tonight you got Paul Candelaria from Philippines. Thank you very much. The guy that you saw the other day, Franklin from Colombia. So it's like the UN. And Ginger Kwan, vocalist. She lives in Italy now.
When people talk about jazz, They often like to talk about which particular style they like. You know, maybe they like West Coast cool jazz or New York bebop. So we asked Alan if he thinks there's a unique Hong Kong sound of jazz.
No. That was quick. Because what I see a lot of young kids, but they want to play so-called jazz rock. So it's, to me, it's more rock. It's not bebop or the blues or anything like that. It's just fusion music. But, and a lot of it's guitar. But it used to be a lot of saxophone. Now it's all guitar, so it's louder and more flash. Ain't nothing. I don't mean that. They can play, but that's what they think. That's what gets promoted as jazz by the government and stuff like that, because they're trying to promote local Hong Kongese people, which is understandable. But that's not promoting jazz. And if you don't go out in the world and learn about what you're trying to play, you can't play. Personal opinion. You know, if you don't travel around the world, what are you playing? You need to hear other people's music. That's easy in Hong Kong because you hear Indian music, this kind of music, Chinese music, you know, traditional Chinese. You know, if you're not there, you don't never hear that. Even if you bought the recordings, but you're meeting people and seeing it live, and some of it's gonna inspire you just like you inspire somebody else with American music. You know, that's how you grow.
And when we ask Alan what's his favorite song to open a set with, the answer is not that simple. Because from behind his keyboard, he's watching the crowd, mixing and matching from hundreds, in fact, thousands of songs he knows, to best suit the mood of the room.
It depends on how I read the audience. Because I'm not trying to highlight myself here. This is not a concert. If it was in a concert or performance, then you have to listen to what I want to play. Now, if I see a certain number of people here or less a number of people, just come out there slamming. You just do make people comfortable and then they won't leave. And then you bump it up.
And what if he sees a couple sitting at a romantic table for two? Does he subtly change the music?
Oh, I'll go ask him. I mean, in a polite way. Because you can tell. And I have a little trick. Oh, good, I didn't lose it. My phone. If you could see, because I could tell you what everybody in here is doing, even if it was full. And if you see the lovey-dovey type thing, it's like, okay, I'm going to mess with them. On my break. Da-da-da-da-da, you're enjoying the music? Oh, yeah, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. That's it. Hold it. Yo, what's up, Stevie? Oh, yeah, she's sitting right here. Oh, okay. Then I say, you know, Stevie Wonder asked me to play this song for your girlfriend or your wife or whatever, dedicated from you to her. Man, it works every time. Then sometimes I'll do the reverse. Okay, well, you know, he got a song. You know, you dedicated that song to her. So the song that works for them that everybody would know would be Loving You by Minnie Riperton. Got the attention. This is from you to him. Then all of a sudden, you're a hero.
Alan celebrated his 70th birthday last December. He reminds us it's the same day as Beethoven's. And at 70 years old, he's still young when it comes to the giants of jazz. Herbie Hancock just turned 84, and Ron Carter is 86. So we asked him that one single question we want to know from all the great musicians and composers. Exactly what inspires him?
Life. And being able to meet people. Well, you know, people ask me, well, are you ever going to retire? Musicians don't retire. You know, if you think, unless something happened to you, I can still teach. But as far as playing, I enjoy playing. And unless there was some reason I couldn't play, I'd probably die on stage with the serious chord fall off. Check this out. Bye.
Let me leave you now with just a little slice of Alan Youngblood and his group playing here in Burt's one Thursday evening not too long ago. My name is Christina Panton. Maybe I'll see you down here one night soon. Thank you.
For this edition of The Correspondent. Thank you for listening, and I do hope you enjoyed it. Don't forget, the FCC is on just about all of your usual social media platforms. You can find us on Instagram and X, formerly known as Twitter, at FCCHK, on Facebook, on LinkedIn, and also don't forget, you can catch up on all the special talks with journalists, authors, and experts we host here at the FCC on our YouTube channel.
Yes, and our YouTube channel is really interesting, Zella. I think the video of Florence Deshungi talking about the missing Malaysian Airlines flight MH370 is still getting views and comments nearly 2 years after we posted it. But there's also conversations with David Tang, Noam Chomsky, a whole lot more people to catch up on. And of course, there's a whole new year of conversations to look forward to ahead.
That's right, Jared. Great to have you here at Burt's. Gong hei fa choy to you for the Year of the Dragon. Once again, thanks for joining us. Bye for now.